Chapter 5, Voices from God. The beginning of November 1988 was much like any other November in Oregon. The hot summer months had produced abundant crops, wheat being the most valuable one that year. All have been harvested, and the people looked forward to Thanksgiving. Then something happened that shocked a lot of people and amazed a great many others. On the morning of November 3, the body of a Newburgh man by the name of Mike Lemke was discovered at the place where he worked, the Phoenix Horse Farm. The next day, the McMinnville News Registry carried this article. A homicide investigation has been launched by the Yamhill County Sheriff's Department of a Newburgh man apparently killed by a gunshot. Identity of the victim was being withheld pending notification of relatives believed to be in the Portland area and or Washington. The body was found by a Newburgh Fire Department rescue squad that was called to the Phoenix Horse Farm at Olds Lane off Highway 240, about 4 miles west of Newburgh, according to Sheriff Glenn Shipman. Detectives from the Sheriff's Department said that a bright red pickup, a horse trailer, and a horse apparently are missing from the ranch, and the horse stables had been burglarized. These incidents are believed linked to the man's shooting death, an official said. Detectives were called in shortly before noon, when they were notified by rescue crew personnel who had been dispatched to the scene in the belief that it was a request for medical assistance. The body was discovered in a small trailer house behind the stable at the ranch, the sheriff said. An all-points bulletin has been issued for the missing vehicle, listed as a 1988 Chevrolet one-ton pickup with dual rear wheels. Anyone with information is asked to contact the sheriff's office in McMinnville. The only information about the apparently missing horse, believed to have been boarded at the ranch, is that it is brown. The victim had been employed as a ranch hand at the horse boarding, sales, and training facility of Craig Porter since about 1979, investigators said. A summary. Before examining how the Halstead sisters and the Greens let themselves be deceived by supernatural forces, I believe that I need to present a quick summary of the murder incident here. After studying more than 1,900 pages of reference material on this case during the past 8 months, consisting of police reports, court transcripts, newspaper articles, etc., I believe that the material written by Paul Frazier, Deputy District Attorney of Josephine County, under the title Scope of Crime, as relating to Sharon Lee Halstead, says it best and in a concise way. Excerpts from it appear below. The defendant in the above-entitled matter is Sharon Lee Halstead, born November 4, 1952. She is the daughter of Richard and Jody Halstead. The defendant comes from a family in which she is a fourth-generation member of the Seventh-day Adventist Church. Her schooling consisted of attending Seventh-day Adventist schools until she was unable to continue due to lack of finances. On April 13, 1979, she married Tex Shively. The defendant has two sons by Mr. Shively. The older, Harry, also known as Michael, was born April 1, 1976. The younger, Leo, was born January 25, 1979. The defendant and Mr. Shively were separated in 1981 and divorced in 1984. Upon the separation, the defendant moved in with her parents for a short period of time in Newburgh, Oregon, and then she had several residences in the Salem-McMinnville area before she subsequently established a residence in McMinnville, Oregon. In approximately 1983, Richard and Jody Halstead moved in with David Green Sr. and his wife in Weimar, Oregon. Mr. Green Sr. and his wife were family friends of the Halsteads, dating back to the 1950s when the Halsteads lived in Southern California. David Green Sr. had a son, David Green Jr., who was married to Lynn Sapensee. Sharon knew David Green Jr. and Lynn through this family relationship. While Richard and Jody Halstead were living with David Green Sr., they were introduced to a group of Seventh-day Adventists who were meeting with a Miss Jean Ketzner in Canyonville, Oregon. The purpose of this group was to become more in tune with God. In other words, the group sought to hear or see God or His angels. Jody and Richard Halstead communicated to Sharon and her sister Deborah what they were learning in this group. Both sisters expressed interest in what was being discussed and learned. In 1983, Sharon came to the belief that Lynn Green was able to receive the Word of God either directly from God or through His angels. Sharon claims that in 1983, Lynn Green told her that God wanted Sharon and Deborah to move to the Grants Pass area. Sharon and Deborah did move to the Grants Pass area. This move was quite sudden and was essentially overnight. Sharon left behind household items such as furniture in McMinnville. These items were subsequently sold by her brother, David Halstead. In the same year, Sharon and Deborah came to the belief that Leo, Sharon's younger son, could see and hear God or his angels. In particular, Leo was able to see and hear an angel that was known as Naked Truth. This gift supposedly was confirmed by Lynn Green and by John Gentry, who in January of 1985 became Sharon's live-in boyfriend. Sometime between 1984 and 1988, Leo lost this gift. However, Leo regained this gift by August of 1988. Deborah left the Grants Pass area in December of 1984. She moved to Texas and then subsequently returned to the Southern California area. In August of 1988, Deborah returned to the Grants Pass area. She initially came to Oregon to assist her sister in a custody battle with Tex Shively. However, Deborah was told by Leo that the angel Naked Truth wanted her to live with her sister in Grants Pass. In September of 1988, Deborah moved from Southern California to live with her sister in Grants Pass. This belief about communicating with God and His angels and also obeying God and His angels became quite profound in Deborah and Sharon. Subsequent search warrants executed at their residence in Grants Pass, Josephine County, Oregon, found papers on which were questions concerning all manner of items, including religion and also questions about everyday activities. These questions had written by them answers that apparently had been received from God or His angels. What would occur is that the person who had the question would inquire of the person who had the gift, Leo or someone else, and then that person would inquire of God or His angels and repeat what God or the angel had to say. The response would be written down by the question, and the person would be expected to obey explicitly the response given. From September 1988 through November 1988, Leo claimed he had the ability to see if someone was totaled. Totaled meant that the person had been overcome by evil spirits or demons. The spirit of that person would no longer exist. The body, now a shell, was filled with evil. Leo further claimed that to take items from a totaled person was not stealing or otherwise wrong. Further, taking from the adversary, the totaled person, was simply reclaiming what the Lord intended for the righteous. The same principle applied to destroying property belonging to totaled people. You would simply destroy the property and not allow the adversary the benefit of the property. Destroying a totaled person was not viewed as being wrong because you were not destroying a human being. With these principles in mind, Leo announced in September of 1988 the beginning of what Deborah Halstead referred to as combat training. Leo indicated that they, meaning Deborah, Sharon, Leo, and Harry, should go to stores belonging to totaled people and steal items. The group went to such stores as Bi-Mart, Kmart, Fred Meyer's, Payless, Albertsons, Safeway, and Shop and Cart, both in Medford and Grants Pass. They stole small items. Failure to follow Leo's command as received from the angel Naked Truth in these areas would result in the disobedient becoming totaled. Becoming totaled was something that both Sharon and Deborah Halstead feared greatly. Sometimes Leo would command that they needed to go back to the same store several times in one day in order to steal. Sharon and Deborah would balk at such a request, but because Leo indicated that they would become totaled, they complied with his directions. Leo claimed that God would disguise the Halstead sisters so that they would not be caught while taking from totaled people. The Halstead group was never caught shoplifting. This fact caused Deborah and Sharon to believe what they were doing was God's work, because of the great number of times they went out and stole and were never caught. Leo also directed that he and his brother Harry should go to totaled persons and slash tires on their automobiles. Sharon and Deborah would drive the two boys to the various locations in Josephine and Jackson counties that Leo directed so that the boys could slash tires. One place they went to slash tires was at Rowe Motors in Grants Pass. This was on October 14, 1988. There is a police report on file with the Grants Pass Police Department showing that there were slashed tires at Rowe Motors on October 14, 1988. While at Rowe Motors, Leo apparently cut his leg in the process of either exiting or entering the Halstead vehicle from slashing tires. Hospital records confirm that on October 14, 1988, Leo needed stitches in his leg for a knife wound. The Grants Pass Police Department had reports of approximately 10 incidences of tire slashing that have been attributed to the Halstead group. In furtherance of this combat training, Leo directed that the group, along with John Gentry, should go to the Rivendale Park and assault totaled people. According to the Grants Pass Police Department records, an assault occurred at Riverside Park in which a Michelle Ann Mitchell was struck on the back of the head with a flashlight. Her companion, Ronald Varner, was also hit in the arm. Subsequent investigation by the Grants Pass Police Department using photo lineups has identified Sharon Halstead as the attacker of Michelle Mitchell. Harry Shively has been identified as the attacker of Ronald Warner. On approximately October 29, 1988, Leo directed that the group should go to the ranch of Craig Porter, located in Newburg, Oregon. At the ranch resided the owner, Craig Porter, a ranch hand, Marson Lemke, and Michael Halstead, brother of Sharon and Deborah Halstead. Leo claimed that all three were totaled. Leo directed that they must go to the ranch. They drove to the ranch and took a dog on October 29. On October 31, 1988, Leo directed that they should return to Newburg and take an all-terrain vehicle from the ranch. On the way to Newburg, while driving through Salem, Leo directed that the group should go to his father's residence, that of Tex Shively, and steal a gun. At some inconvenience because of their location on the freeway, They exited the freeway and went to Tex Shively's home. Deborah and Sharon waited in the car while both boys entered Mr. Shively's residence. Leo stole a .38 caliber handgun. Both boys returned to the car and the gun was given to Sharon. At that point in time, they proceeded to Newburgh and stole the ATV. On this trip, Leo and Sharon test-fired the handgun. Between October 31 and November 2, 1988, ammunition was obtained for the gun. Deborah Halstead has claimed that she stole two boxes of ammunition from G.I. Joe's in Medford. However, the two boxes of ammunition recovered pursuant to search warrants in this matter show that one box of ammunition came from G.I. Joe's and the other came from a Bi-Mart store. On November 1, 1988, Sharon rented a storage locker, Grants Pass, Oregon. On November 2, 1988, Leo directed that the group must return to the Newburgh Ranch and steal other items from the ranch. They did return to the ranch, and taken from the ranch was approximately $50,000 of items, including a bright red pickup truck, a horse trailer, a horse, a large amount of tack, and other items taken from Michael Halstead's apartment. The apartment was vandalized and was literally trashed by the boys. Apparently, Leo further directed that Craig Parter, Michael Halstead, and Marston Lemke were all totaled. He further directed that if any of the three were at the ranch while they removed items, they must be destroyed. Leo gave specific instructions on who was to do what at the ranch. While there, Marston Lemke, who was familiar with the group as Michael Halstead's family, approached them. After identifying them as Michael Halstead's family, he returned to his trailer located on the ranch property. After loading up the stolen items, Deborah and Lee left the ranch. Sharon, under Lee's direction, went with Harry to Marston Lemke's trailer and shot him 3 times with the gun stolen from Tex Shively. Michael Shively stood nearby while Sharon Halstead knocked on the door. Lemke answered. There was a brief conversation. Sharon then shot Lemke in the upper right chest shoulder with the revolver. As he spun around from this first shot, she shot him again in the side. He then fell to the floor with his upper body on a bed. Sharon then at least partially entered the trailer and fired the fatal shot to the side of the neck. A fourth round was fired as Sharon Halstead slipped while running from the trailer. Sharon Halstead and her son, Michael Shively, then left the area in the Halstead vehicle and met with Deborah Halstead and Leo Shively at a prearranged location. The four then proceeded to return to the Grants Pass area. Arriving in the early morning hours of November 3, 1988, it should be noted that upon stealing the truck from Yamhill County, the Halstead group drove the bright red truck to numerous locations in Grants Pass and took no effort to conceal it. Leo claimed that God would disguise the truck, or in other words, change the color and scramble the license plate's numbers to avoid detection until the truck could be painted. Arrangements were made by Sharon Halstead to have the truck painted. On November 4, 1988, the horse that was stolen from the ranch was boarded at Mary Lowe's Horse Hotel, located in Grants Pass, Oregon. On the same day, the group, under the direction of Leo, stole a motorcycle from Grants Pass Suzuki on the Rouge River Highway. That motorcycle was placed in the storage locker. We would like to know. For a number of months as I worked on this book manuscript, many individuals have asked me how in the world two intelligent young persons could be led to kill someone without being on drugs or other mind-altering substances. To help people understand the motivating force in this tragedy, I tell them to take a good look at the experience of the Branch Davidians and their leader David Koresh, who in 1993 brought almost 100 of his people to a fiery death outside of Waco, Texas. For months after federal agents stormed the heavily armed fortress of the Branch Davidians, criminologists, law enforcement analysts, military experts, sociologists, psychiatrists, behavioral scientists, religion scholars, and many others have devoted great amounts of time to studying that tragedy and the reasons it took place. Being retired gave me the time to listen to special reports on television and to read in newspapers detailed accounts of the research such experts conducted as they sought to explain how David Koresh could lead so many people to their death in the way he did. They came up with many conclusions, but to me the best and most accurate reason that I have ever heard to explain Waco did not come from the specialists and experts studying Koresh and his followers, but from the Satanist priest I knew back in 1946. For a long time I felt reluctant to tell much about what he had said. I never even told my own children that I had been a spiritist until they were grown. But as the years go by and events confirm his words, I find myself in each book repeating more and more of what he told his followers. He explained how demonic spirits use charismatic individuals to manipulate other people, luring them into various types of bondage. The priest claimed that supernatural beings find their best subjects in the religious world, adding that spirits can induce thoughts and images into the human mind in such a way that people believe the thoughts to be their own. He also stated that spirit beings can produce powerful feelings in individuals and a love of the extreme. Once a person has reached that point, he argued, the spirits are able to cripple the intelligence and take total control. Consider the way David Koresh and his people thought and felt. The Branch Davidians held a position common to all extremists and fanatical groups. They believed strongly that they alone had and understood all truth, and that they alone were God's true followers. They felt that the great zeal they possessed for their cause came from the Holy Spirit Himself. It is sad that many Christians place so much trust in the way they feel, and do not realize that Satan and his angels are experts at making people feel good about many things, even cherishing error. In the 1993 updating of my book, Trip into the Supernatural, I recounted how the Spiritist priest said Satan had led much of the world to conclude that he and his demons do not exist. Satan, he said, introduced new beliefs that nullified the Bible, while at the same time he placed restrictions on the activities of the fallen angels. From then on, they would no longer be allowed to play with superstitious people. For instance, for centuries in certain parts of the world, demonic spirits had led people to believe that it was bad luck to sleep in a room numbered 13, and made sure that many who did would meet with some misfortune. The inhabitants of rural districts of northern Europe still stir batter in a clockwise direction even to this day, and housewives firmly believe that to reverse directions will surely bring bad luck. The priest explained to us how things that we laugh about today, such as stirring batter counterclockwise, was serious business 300 years ago when Satan's angels reinforced people's belief by bringing some misfortune into the lives of those who did not respect superstitions held by their elders. He described also how the spirits at times gave power to certain objects and amazed people as they realized that some supernatural force lurked behind it all. In many instances, they actually appeared to people as beautiful angels, and at other times, they materialized as human beings. In that way, strong beliefs and fears held people in a constant state of uncertainty about life and in a condition of willing obedience. The spirits greatly enjoyed the whole thing because they love to distress, perplex, and oppress us. The priest told us how Satan figured that a few generations would have to pass before people would look back upon their ancestors as superstitious because of their ignorance of the world around them. From that time on, he said, more and more people would declare that Satan and his angels do not really exist. Fascinated with new light. The Halsted sisters were victimized, taken advantage of by demonic spirits, because Satan is now removing the restrictions that have held a vast number of his angels in check for more than 200 years. To understand the implications of this, we explore further something that I alluded to previously. Well, during the late 1970s, certain evangelical Christians became fascinated with what they referred to as new light, concepts that they felt had been withheld from Christians for too long. They started to press God for new knowledge and insights. Other individuals became obsessed with the idea that the time was right to ask God to allow them to see and talk with angels that would instruct them in new and better ways of serving Him. A desire for self-exaltation prompted many of these requests. It gave people an unconscious feeling of superiority and security to think that they could learn hidden things from a supernatural being, that they have direct channels with God. Proving the existence of God, knowing more than others do, can be as addictive as any drug. At the same time, it opened the way for Satan's angels to appear to certain persons and claim to have come from heaven itself. Little by little, such false angels went about perverting the gospel of Christ. As I saw such a trend taking place in some non-Adventist churches, I wondered how long it would take for demonic spirits to infiltrate the thinking of God's commandment-keeping people in such a way and deceive many of them. Also during the 1980s, when some Protestants concluded they were becoming demon-possessed, the spiritual leaders who in reality had set the people up to become demon-possessed lost no time in taking advantage of the situation. They held exorcisms that went on sometimes for most of the day in attempts to remove dozens of demons from a person. The power of fallen angels that Satan himself had held back for more than 200 years again operated openly in the lives of Christians. As I saw these two avenues of access to Christians swing wide open so that Satan's angels could appear to people as angels of light, I began looking for and reading all kinds of materials by Seventh-day Adventists who claimed to be receiving new light from God through His angels. At that time, I was teaching a large Sabbath school class and asked my class members to bring me any and all materials written by Seventh-day Adventists who made any reference to receiving new light from God or angels. And sure enough, before long, it started drifting in. I discovered that my Sabbath school members had contacted friends and relatives from many parts of the USA and Canada, asking them to send any material they came across advocating new light. For instance, I came to know of certain individuals who are now Adventist exorcists, when they were just being initiated into that practice. I became aware of independent individuals who had begun sowing discontent and disaffection among the ranks of Seventh-day Adventists before they had attracted enough of a following for our church leaders to notice them. Voices from God. Some of the materials that came to me through my Sabbath school members told of individuals being instructed by angels about things that would enrich their Christian walk and help prepare people for the soon coming of Jesus. People accepted alleged revelations on new ways of understanding and pleasing God, especially when it came through children in their early teens or younger. Many individuals did not hesitate to accept the teachings as coming from God, concluding that it would be totally impossible for young children to have conceived such things in their own minds. Every so often I would receive material telling of someone having received a message from God through a voice speaking directly above them. One man standing in his driveway thought he received a message from God telling him to prepare to build a temple in Oregon where the Ark of the Covenant could be kept until the coming of Christ. God supposedly told a woman that he would be unlocking truths for our time by his angels and for her to be alert and believe. A 14-year-old girl believed angelic beings transported her to various parts of the world and showed her where important events would soon take place. An angel often visited an 11-year-old boy and took him to certain parts of the world, including Vatican City, where the angel instructed him on a number of important events that would occur there during the closing of Earth's history. Thought messages from God. In 1983, the idea surfaced that the dispensation of the gospel had closed, and that a new era had begun known as the dispensation of the Spirit. Some also referred to it as the advanced Christian pathway to sanctification. Along with it came the message that God had chosen a new way of communicating with his people, through our thoughts. Here are a couple of excerpts from material advocating it. This communication, or speaking through thought, is the basic way used by the Father to communicate with his people today. This communication network is the very foundation necessary for the reception of the Spirit. It is so important that without this becoming experiential reality in the life, there cannot and will not be any connection or relationship with heaven established. This is the very essence of the sanctification process in the life. Experience has shown that the main vehicle used in these times is thought, which a believer soon learns to recognize as coming from the Spirit. These thoughts seem like your own, but you begin to realize that on your own you would not be thinking that way. Moreover, the light given is recognized as something beyond the mind of man to conceive. End of quote. The publication also stated that months later, the angel of the Christian pathway made a personal appearance to a group on a Sabbath afternoon and shed even more light about what to expect on this pathway. The so-called angel informed them that some will be given miraculous powers as gifts. This gift involves the ability to control the elements of nature, such as causing rain to fall, earthquakes, droughts, or whatever the Lord wills for the person to do. These people will also be able to transport themselves from one place to another, raise the dead to life, heal the sick, etc. This has been revealed by the angels of the Lord. End of quote. It is said that some of the people involved in these beliefs experience visible contact with supernatural beings, and that they see angels, both good and bad, converse with them, and witness unusual miracles. In addition, proponents teach that both good and evil angels have names that denote their functions, such as angel of comfort, angel of doubt, etc. They claim that Jesus has come to some as an angel of knowledge. Another account tells of foreign persons from places such as China, France, Ireland, and South America who have been supernaturally transported to the United States, homes of some Seventh-day Adventists. Angels and Jesus himself arranged for the meetings. I would consider these incidents to be the materialization of demonic spirits. The people involved in such phenomena claim that some Seventh-day Adventists who are experiencing the latter rain have received the gift of tongues to converse with the visitors. The interviews have lasted from a few minutes to a half hour in length after the foreigner appeared within the room. Also, such individuals teach that total perfection achieved under latter rain sanctification will make it so that a person will no longer have a need for Christ's righteousness. Such an idea is contrary to the plain, simple, and beautiful teachings of Scripture on how to be saved. In fact, it does away with the Bible as the standard, model, and rule by which we are to fashion our lives as the Spirit of God operates in us to make our characters like that of Christ. The Apostle Paul worried that false teachers might cheat Christians of his day of their eternal reward. To the Corinthians he wrote, "I fear lest by any means, as the serpent beguiled Eve through his subtlety, so your minds should be corrupted from the sincerity that is in Christ." 2 Corinthians 11:3. His concern for God's people was well founded, and he explained in verses 13 and 14 why he felt the way he did. "For such are false apostles, deceitful workers, transforming themselves into the apostles of Christ. And no marvel, for Satan himself is transformed into an angel of light. And I say unto you, my readers, beware of playing games with angels, as it is a very dangerous thing to do. Grandmother Eve did, and we all landed outside the Garden of Eden, living in misery, all of us walking in one direction, to a grave."